Today on ABCDTOS, a private little war.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to ABCDTOS, the podcast where we are going through every episode of Star Trek, the original series, in alphabetical order, from All Our Yesterdays to Wolf in the Fold. I'm John Engel.
I'm a Joe Mazel.
I'm Pete the Retailer.
And I am Tom Taylor.
And as you said, we're going through a private little war. We're having a private little war, everybody. Just please.
You guys stink.
Give us our privacy.
Don't cross this line.
Yeah, here's the Google blurb. It's season 2, episode 19, if you're watching it. Season 2, episode 16, if you're making it. Mm-hmm. February 2nd, 1968,
I think.
David Naughton. Yeah, 2-2. 2-2.
2 weeks 68. In a row with that joke. That's great, right. Job, Joe.
If it's funny once, it's funny twice.
Or, conversely, if it's never funny once, if
maybe
it's
not.
Just never funny. Perhaps not.
I stand by my belief system.
Anyway, February 2nd, 1968, and it's a private little war. Kirk's reunion with an old friend on the planet Neural, which we'll talk about, is overshadowed by a threat from the Klingons, which leaves the captain contemplating a breach of Starfleet's standing order of non-intervention in order to help a beleaguered race.
That's not entirely inaccurate.
How is this like our fifth consecutive Prime Directive episode? I feel like it's been nonstop lately.
P is for Prime Directive. That's what they say.
I guess so. It is. Yeah, you're right.
It's good enough for me.
Yeah. Hey, P is also for, did everybody watch this on Amazon?
Yeah, I watched it on Paramount Plus.
It is listed as a private light war.
Oh.
What?
Oh,
like,
wow.
Like they just left the L out. L-I-T-T-E.
Liddy war.
Yeah, a private Liddy war.
War.
Say, Tom, since you are watching on Amazon, do they still offer the non-remastered version of the episodes?
Last time I looked, but somebody on our briefing room thing on Facebook said they're evaporating. They're going away.
Well, all the Star Trek leaving Amazon. They're leaving Amazon. I mean, you're going to have to get Paramount Plus. The question is, will Paramount Plus have both?
Yeah.
Like
they do not currently.
No, they don't.
So,
not on Amazon either?
I don't think so.
I have my Paramount Plus through Amazon Prime.
What?
That's weird.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like any other, like you can get your HBO or any channel at all through Amazon
Prime. It makes
it
really hard to quit, though. Really hard to cancel or restart or something. Mm-hmm. Or at least I've had hard times. No?
Nope. Okay. It's really easy. I don't know.
Oh, never mind.
As a matter of fact, I'll often get a channel on Prime, like get it, the money goes through, and I'll immediately cancel it.
Oh,
just
nice.
To limit myself to have 1 month of it.
Ooh, wait a minute. You can get all these channels in Amazon Prime? What a wonderful streaming service.
That's not all.
Oh, no. Maybe. Wait a minute. Here's Star Trek, the original series.
It's the Burger King of streaming.
But it doesn't. I don't know if this is. It's a different link, I think, than a Star Trek original remastered.
Mm-hmm. It's the guy from the Mod Squad. Yeah.
So look at that. But let me
different
tell you,
link.
I'm getting
more of Lancelot and Link myself. Mm.
I'm getting notifications every time I click on it here. I'm getting a little thing. Yeah, it looks like it might be. They might still have the originals, but no matter what I click on, I'm getting a little triangle alert on each one. Star Trek leaves Prime in 12 days as of this recording.
My God.
So,
boy, you said the remaster or the unremastered ones are not
all the original series is leaving Prime in 12 days.
I don't like it. That makes my life slightly more difficult.
Oh, as of this recording, 12 days. So that's probably the end of the year. So probably January 1, no more.
I think the end of the year is going to be a massive change in streaming all around. Maybe. I want to say that the 20th Century Fox deals all end at the end of the year. So that means Disney's going to vault up a bunch of movies that they all will now own completely.
Mm.
It's kind of scary.
Mm.
And John, by the way, your Lancelot Link reference is just one of the reasons I love and admire you.
No.
I think I even said it wrong, though. I think I said Lancelot and Link.
Be that as it may.
Link Ray. Links.
Hey,
Pete, did you see Link Ray with me? No, that was somebody else. Okay.
No, I didn't.
This is getting subspace chattery, guys.
Yeah, subspace chatter.
Which I is think, our, by the way, our Patreon offerings.
Patreon.com. Well, abcdtos.com/Patreon will take you. It'll look like the ABC. It's both the ABCDTOS Patreon and ABC Devo Patreon.
And same next thing, week, I access. Predict that we are going to talk about all the times Pete and I saw Reverend Horton Heat together.
That could be. I was going to say we saw Dick Dale, but
did
not,
we?
I did. Oh. I don't know. I thought you were with me.
I mean, it sounds like something I would go to, but I have no recollection of seeing Dick Dale.
It's not with Mr. Jerry.
That is too bad.
Mr. Jerry. It was like, you know, he was probably a teenager at the time.
That would do it.
Jerry Lewis?
Yes.
Yeah.
Jerry Lewis. He was a teenager.
Yeah. He was up in the Catskills.
Hey, Gene, we want to see old rockabilly recording artists in their 70s. It's the best way to do it. Oh, come on, Pally. You don't want to see that.
So while we're here, I did a weird thing where I did all my other, my behind-the-scenes notes up top. Up top. High five.
Mm-hmm.
And then my plot notes later. So I'm going to start with those if you guys will indulge me here.
Please.
This episode was written by Don Ingalls, but he is listed as a pseudonym, Judd Crucis, as in like Jesus on the cross, because he felt so betrayed by Gene Roddenberry's rewrite of his material.
Wow.
When you guys saw the opening credits, did you immediately think like, oh man, I wonder how this is going to be sexist?
No.
Wow, that went over like a lead balloon. I see a teleplay by Gene Roddenberry. I'm like,
right.
All right, how is this going to be problematic? You see, yeah, that's
definitely
the thing there.
and it you know, it does. It has its issues. Well.
And it met at school.
coincidentally, yes. My grandfather's name was Don Engel.
Oh,
not Donald. Don. He did not write any Star Trek episodes.
No. Even under a pseudonym?
Just more is a pity.
No, his he was a terrible man, and his episodes would have been horrible, even worse than Roddenberry's, I'm sure.
Nah. Well, so it seems like Don Ingalls and Roddenberry were friends going all the way back for a while, but this episode that just like he felt so betrayed by this, and who knows if it led to, if it was on a personal level or if it was just on a professional level, but apparently he had a lot more in the original drafts. There was a lot more kind of overt Vietnam references.
More over?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Roddenberry,
like, literally added, Viet people in like American Army uniforms.
More overt than the Omega Glory?
Let me see what Richard Don Ingalls. According to the Star Trek Compendium, this script referred to Apella as a Ho Chi Minh type and the tribesmen wearing Mongolian clothes. Though friends with Roddenberry since their days as LAPD officers, Ingalls did not like the changes in the pseudonym. Another thing that was originally in the script, the monster was called the Gumato, and then DeForest Kelly kept saying it wrong, couldn't get it right, so they're like, screw it, we'll just change it.
That's great.
Which is terrific.
But they didn't change Sellet.
No. The cast notes here. Oh, first of all, so we let's talk about our two main people on the planet. Our neurals or whatever. That's such a weird. they don't mention it in the episode, but in the script apparently, the planet is called Neural.
All right,
which is bizarre.
That's weird.
But our the two neurals that we know so well. We've got Tyree, which again, let's go back to the image of George Lucas sitting there writing up scripts and watching Star Trek.
Yeah.
Gold 2, Tyree.
After this, watch Star Trek.
Gold 2,
Hutch.
Gold 3. Gold 2. Gold 3 is Pops, I think.
Mm.
And
wow, it's like you're an expert on classic Star Wars. It's a really weird thing.
Right.
Yeah. That's weird.
And you got Tyree, who's played by Michael Whitney, who is perhaps best known as Mr. Twiggy. He married Twiggy.
Wow. Okay. I don't think he's Buck Rogers direction.
Not Mr. Twiggy. Mr. Twiggy.
Beatty.
Beatty. Kirk.
And in the episode, he's married to Nona. Which is funny because it's
no.
She's not an Italian grandmother. Nona, played by Nancy Kovac.
By this point, she might be.
She's Nancy Novak, who is best known to the world as Mrs. Zubin Mehta. So, we have a weird like these two people famous from other things, spouses are married in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an odd thing. Tyree died early, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe Nancy Kovac is still around, still, and sometimes goes by Nancy Mehta.
A couple things just before we press on. Mm-hmm. Number one, Tyree and his mountain men clan really reminded me of the guys in The Changeling. And more specifically, Tyree kind of reminded me of Eve of Destruction singer Barry McGuire.
Hmm.
That is a reference for all of our fans who are in their 70s. But, right. You know,
right.
While I'm much younger than you and have much more vitality in life and your people are dying, right. I still can relate.
Yeah. And you tell me over and over and over again.
Yes. And it's the only song I know of that has the word coagulate in it. So there you go.
I will say that when Nona arrives, I immediately wrote the note, Russ Meyer's Star Trek.
Yeah.
Because I really think she's straight out of like Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Mm-hmm.
And I like it. I like it. It's not like a negative stance. Thing at all. I love
wonder
it.
What Roddenberry added to the script. Let's see.
Did anybody do any research on her career? Because she really is like a dancer in the best possible way. Like she has a physicality to her. Besides being an attractive woman, like she has a physicality to her that's sort of unique.
To the point where you're like, unique to is she episode. Okay? Is she she doesn't seem to be able to stand straight.
Nancy Kovac.
She's okay.
She began her career as one of Jackie Gleason's Glee girls on the Jackie Gleason show.
Presumably, that is the equivalent of Dean Martin's Gold Diggers, which is to say they were dancers.
Something like that, yeah. She was Perry Mason, Alfred Hitchcock, 12 O'Clock High, blah, 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 which is the bottom of the sea. I Dream of Jeannie, Batman.
Every show in the 60s.
Yeah, Get Smart, Hawaii 5-0, Man from U.N.C.L.E., 2 episodes of that. Multiple episodes of Bewitched.
Any Mission Impossible? Any Desilu proper stuff?
I don't see any right now.
Columbo.
Although, she was nominated for an Emmy for her performance in an episode of Mannix called The Girl Who Came In with the Tide. And she was in a bunch of movies. She was Medea in Jason and the Argonauts.
Yes, that I noticed. And great movie. Everybody see Jason and the Argonauts.
Wild Westerners, Diary of a Madman, 1965, Three Stooges comedy, The Outlaws is Coming.
That's when they were at their prime.
Yeah. Everybody loves those 60s Three Stooges comedies.
Yeah, when they were too old to hit each other.
And 1966 Elvis Presley musical, Frankie and Johnny.
You know, they were lovers.
Like Susie and Jeffrey. Her last film to date was the 1969 science fiction drama Marooned. What a maroon. Mm.
Featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah.
Ackman and Gregory Peck.
That's and then right. After 1969, that's when she met and married Zubin Mehta. And then she focused just more on married life. Every once in a while, she'd pop up on TV, apparently. And
good for her.
Full on retired in 75. Mm. Nothing about her being a dancer specifically, but she does live with a musician. So, so two more. No, well, one is not a behind the scenes cast, our first Mabenga. That children's book, My First Mabenga. Which is an interesting. Now, is this well? So Sulu does not appear in this episode. And here's my headcanon for my behind the scenes headcanon is that please. Is this a Green Berets episode for him? Is he gone because
if it's
of that?
Second season? Probably
because you have here's part of the plot where we have somebody who's. We have a character who's established as a botanist. He's not in this episode, but the doctor is getting plant samples and then he has to go back down to the planet. So we're going to have a different doctor that we've never seen before. And it's like, it seems to me like maybe they were, you know, maybe it was originally a Sulu thing. And especially if, as originally mentioned,
they were making
a lot more kind of like overt Vietnam references and just like the other, you know, if they were making more references to Asian history, perhaps they might have included Sulu in that. And then Dr. McCoy could have been just Dr. McCoying it up. Yeah.
I was wondering if they did that or if they added her because or if added the new doctor because if there wasn't another doctor and McCoy was on the planet, then Chapel would be the head of sickbay for a while and dealing with Spock by herself and they couldn't handle that or something. I don't know. That seemed I feel like she could have done just well. I mean, he, you know, the doctor does bring in, you know, specific specialized information about Vulcan, whatever and stuff. So. I don't know.
I read somewhere that what was the episode right before this one?
Yeah, alphabetically or production?
No, in production order and airing order.
Previously, one produced right before this is Journey to Babel.
But I think it was Immunity Syndrome, the one that aired before this. I don't know. I read somewhere that someone speculated that there was an issue with Vulcan physiology in a previous episode, maybe the one right before this, so it made sense that a guy would be brought on to have expertise in that.
Immunity Syndrome was aired right before this.
Good pull, John.
And so Mbenga was played by Booker Bradshaw, who wrote a Columbo episode.
There you go.
The episode we discussed, I think, last week, Playback, with Jenna Rollins.
Awesome.
He wrote that episode. He wrote a lot of television, some Planet of the Apes episodes, some Rockford Files. So maybe he was hanging with David Chase.
Nice.
Marky Mods. Moon. He wrote a lot of television. Thank you.
Oh, he was one of the writers on that. He was one of the writers on the Richard Pryor show.
Wow.
Which, you know, the notorious Richard Pryor show that didn't go very far. But,
But it does have the Star Wars bar sketch, which is amazing.
What's the first thing that happened? Isn't like he's nude from the waist down without a penis? Isn't that like the whole series? And he was also in Coffee, which makes him really cool all by itself.
I noticed that, and Coffee's amazing.
So, cool guy.
Cool guy.
The basic episode is that the basis of the episode is that the Klingons are supplying the villagers.
Wait, I had one more behind the scenes cast note thing.
Please.
Before we move on to the plot. Krell. There's a guy named Krell, which is funny because it sounds like, I don't know, sounds like a name you would make up if you're making fun of sci-fi. Call this guy Krell.
We don't want to have Krill because that's plankton. But how about Krell?
Can't have Kroll because you can't have Prell because that's a shampoo.
But Krell is the Klingon commander, and originally it was going to be Kor, I think, and they were like, weirdly, somebody was just like, come on, like all these Klingons all in the galaxy and Kirk keeps running into the same one, and I was like, now, like, you're worried about that now? Like, look at all the other stuff that's going on and you're worried about that, like, in this one? What But apparently that was, they were like, oh, let's make it a different Klingon, so they make it Krell. It's played by Ned Romero, who has a weird, he's in original series, Next Gen, and Voyager, each time playing a different character. Which is interesting and odd.
He's the Mark Leonard of Star Trek. Mark Leonard's the Mark Leonard of Star Trek.
Yeah, there you go. he's Krell here. He plays Anthwara in Next Gen episode called Journey's End. And he plays Chakotay's grandfather in Voyager.
Oh, wow.
How would Chakotay's grandfather ever enter into an episode of Voyager? I can't remember that. Seems like it'd be difficult. But then again, they have a.
Does he do some kind of like
holodeck
spiritual like?
Yeah,
like
probably.
Vision quest.
Oh yeah. God, that's probably.
I'm sure it has aged wonderfully.
Yeah. he plays a guy named Hector Alonso in the Galactica 1980 episode Space Croppers.
Is that Hector Elizondo?
Yeah, I was about to say.
He plays Hector
Romero
Elizondo.
Hector Elizondo.
In Pretty Woman behind the scenes.
Anyway, Krell, everybody. All right, now let's talk about the plot.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
So here's a thing I wanted to say that tangentially is involved in the plot. So the basic premise of the episode is that the Klingons are supplying the villagers as opposed to the mountain men. Is that right?
Yeah, no, the Klingons are supplying the... Oh, yeah, yeah.
Supplying the Trilogers, the Mountain Men are Tyree and his buddies.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
What I kind of find interesting is an episode with Klingons, but they really don't use Klingons. Mm-hmm. Like, to its credit, it doesn't end with... It doesn't climax with, like, Kirk and a Klingon having a fist fight. It's like the Klingons are in one, maybe two scenes... Or a Klingon is in one or two scenes, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And now we have to worry about these sort of bigger issues within the episode.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a, you know, an interesting tactic to take, especially despite, you know, kind of like when you're a kid watching Star Trek. All in all, Klingons aren't in that many episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny to hear that they were thinking of having it be a Klingon we've seen already, because in this episode, who would care? Like, Kirk barely even interacts with any of them, and that would have been kind of a waste.
Which is, we'll get there. I want to bring that back up, but...
All right.
Yes, it is odd to be like... didn't that happen before? That was, I forgot what was the other episode, not too long ago, where the Klingons were just there to be like... Almost like to be like the annoying Commodore, where they're just like, the Klingons, like, we got to do this quick. Otherwise, the Klingons, like, they're just, we didn't even see them. It was just like some ships.
Mm-hmm.
They're so McCoy is down on the planet, getting some, let me directly paraphrase, and it's not just him. Kirk says it this way too. Roots and soil samples. Roots.
Yeah.
Why? What happened to Spock? Where is he?
Well, they're all down there, and then they get some soil samples, and they see that Kirk is doing the thing that he did on Kirok, Paradise Syndrome. He's doing the same thing where he's just like, this is beautiful, isn't it? Everybody's so simple, like they're all living, hanging out.
Be a shame if something happened to it.
And he's telling Spock, you know, early on in his career, he did a study there, essentially.
Exchange student program.
Determined that they, you know, should not interfere. Like, assessed, went undercover, assessed the level of development for this planet. And then all of a sudden, but then they see the... the villagers have rifles. The other people have rifles. They're like, what's going on? And they start to kind of protect their friends a little bit without using their phasers. And then they get chased, and Spock gets hit with a musket ball, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Through all the way through.
Shot through.
There's green paint on both sides of his shirt, which implies to me that it was shot all the way through.
Although not a hole in either side of the uniform.
No hole, and it would be like the center of his chest. That would be incredibly damaging no matter what your physiology is.
No matter where the galaxy you're from, that's got to hurt.
They say like that his kidney got...
His liver.
Injured, right?
Or his liver. Says, yeah, his good thing is his liver is where his heart should
All right,
be.
Where his heart
good
should be.
Good thing is Gizzard wasn't right there.
It's hot. Although I do love any occurrence of Spock's green blood makes me happy. In not, mm-hmm. you know, only because I know he'll be okay. But, you know, like in what is it, Patterns of Force, where they were getting whipped and you see the green welts. And anytime it's like, I get it. Like he's... Mm-hmm. You know, he's different, and
it's nice.
He's a green blooded.
Attention.
It's a nice little attention to detail.
Yeah,
the show,
absolutely.
And the show does that. You know,
McCoy's not just making up stuff to make fun of him. He's actually got green blood.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Even if they literally just took some like light green spray paint and just went on both sides of him, and that's what it looks like.
What are you trying to say, John?
it's just hilariously not blood.
Right.
But. It's still cool.
I wonder what they get like. I wonder if they could get away with more gore, just by having green blood. You know, by like if it was like real looking, you know, human blood, they would get censored. But if it was just like, you know, Spock was just like green pouring out of his mouth, and like, oh god, I don't think I'm gonna make it, and like, you know, just like trying to hold it in like his intestines, but there's like green goo just bubbling out, like
I think that the politics of Mr. Vidal would probably not go over well in middle America at the time.
You couldn't do that on TV. More gore.
This is a
visit to a small planet, is it not?
This made me think of one of my favorite visual gags from the show Spaced, when they're Simon Pegg and Nick Frost are at the paint. They're in a paint war.
Yep.
And he gets, Nick Frost gets hit. Simon Pegg puts him in his arms, and then all this paint just comes out of Nick Frost's mouth. Like, it makes absolutely no sense. Really funny. Anyway, sorry. Just awesome. Made me think of that.
So they come, back
Peter
up.
Peter Fenowitz.
Yes.
Part. Oh, yeah. They're fighting.
Bonjour.
Bagley. Something Bagley. I can't remember his name anyway. Great show. Not the one we're talking about, though.
No.
They come back up to their ship, and they're trying to figure out what's going on. How do these people get rifles? They shouldn't. It would take them. And then there's a great, like, you know, he's on the bridge, and Kirk is kind of like wondering out loud. He's like, where, you know, they just barely discovered, you know, rocks, and now they've got, like, rifles? Mm-hmm. Like, how long, you know, that just seems like it should take forever. And like, Uhura first, which I love that she's just like, yeah, on Earth it took about 12 centuries. Like, she just knows. She doesn't look it up. She doesn't ask the computer. Right. She was just like, yeah, about 12 centuries on Earth. And then everybody else chimes in with their own things. And he's like, all right. That should have been a captain's log.
I'm not here
log.
For a debate.
Yeah. Just because Spock and McCoy aren't here doesn't mean I'm looking for like a big triumvirate of people to talk to.
They get kind of obnoxious. I kind of understand why it's annoying.
The captain's talking to us. This is great.
That is my favorite scene in this episode. I love that there's a little quorum there. And I love that somebody that, whether it's Roddenberry or whether it is the original writer of the episode, had the thought of like, no, there should actually be a discussion. It's very, in the best way, TNG, where it's kind of like, all right, well, just because it took 12 centuries on Earth to go from the Iron Age to like early gunpowder doesn't mean that every planet's going to develop in the same way. Yeah, but wait a minute. Blah, 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 blah. You know, like there's this sort of like, we're all smart people who have our own ideas. Let's discuss is a nice little angle on this episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's brief. And Kirk cuts them off with, I'm not here for a debate. You know?
He does apologize.
I was talking to the audience.
Yeah.
It does raise the old chestnut of the, you know, the inconsistency of knowledge on the show. Because we just recently had them completely befuddled by an automobile. But yet, at every moment in this episode, they know everything about the history of gun. Yeah. The evolution of guns. McCoy immediately knows, hey, we got sulfur here and coal here. They're making guns. They're making gunpowder. Right. It's like, what? How do you guys know all this stuff?
Yeah. It's just like the Battle of Hastings.
You know, I will say this, not to backtrack to a piece of the action, but when there are those sort of like temporal inconsistencies, like I can drive a car. You put me on a horse, it's going to be a little awkward.
Right. And, you know, I wouldn't know about, you know, if suddenly I was like, oh, good, a flintlock. I wouldn't be able to instantly use it. I would be I don't know. Oh, I believe it was called a powder horn.
I was even confused by this episode. They're like the guy's holding a rifle. He's like, oh, next I'll teach you about the, what was it like? The
rifling.
It was a piece of the gun, or the rifle barrel. I'll teach you about the rifle barrel. Yeah. It'll teach you, you'll shoot straighter and farther. I'm like, that's not a rifle barrel?
They've got stacks of holding rifle a rifle. Barrels in that forge.
Those are barrels of a gun, but they're not rifled. Rifle is when you
But
make
the guy's
a little...
holding a big, long gun. I'm like, I would call that a rifle gun. With a rifle barrel.
Okay. Well,
what do I know?
As I had a, you know, kind of anal American history teacher. In junior high school, rifling is kind of like spinning the barrel a la what you see in the opening of a James Bond film.
Right.
The rifling, what it does is it makes the bullet or it makes the musket ball spin. And when it spins out of the barrel itself, it fires straighter.
That makes sense.
One of the reasons why the Americans, from what I remember from junior high school, won a lot of battles in the Revolutionary War is because they developed rifling, which meant their shots were more accurate, where the English army did not have rifling, so their kind of bullets shot all over the place.
Mm.
Right.
All right. Is that what he says?
Yeah,
he says he's going to develop rifling.
Yeah.
He just said, I'll teach you about the rifle barrel is what
rifles,
I thought he said.
Yeah.
He does
as a past tense verb.
Gotcha.
So they're gonna make those James Bond spirals. Yes. In the inside, it's a little go.
How many centuries was it between the first film thing and a James Bond movie? Uhura, go. Yeah. How long did that take? It doesn't make sense that they'd have a James Bond movie by now.
Uhura, when were shoelaces invented? Just, totally, I want to see them just like asking her all kinds of random stuff. Like,
what is the trivia night on the end?
What do you call those things on the end of shoelaces? Aglets. Their purpose is sinister.
Yeah. So yeah, then they go back down to the plane. They're like, all right, we got to go check out what's going on. McCoy, come with me. Let's get some. Where is he? Like, there's these odd references. Instead of like the one time he was like, in Patterns of Force, they're just like, yeah, have the computer make a Nazi outfit. They're just like, tell ship stores we're gonna need like. I love that the idea that there's somebody downstairs, like a big closet, being like, no.
Yeah.
We need that scene with like the
head.
What do we look like? Paramount?
Yeah. Like the musical montage of them trying on different outfits and you know, somebody being like, no, that's not.
I loved how those outfits didn't quite flatteringly fit any cast member.
Right.
Right. Like, this is clearly
a,
like,
the wigs
Shatner,
as a part of that outfit.
No, I mean specifically the vests, where like Tyree is fine. McCoy, it's sort of like, you know, it is basically like a very tight fit waistcoat. And with Kirk, it's just kind of like he rolled out of bed after, you know, after an all nighter.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which entirely possible.
Who knows?
I like to think that it's McCoy here going with him, and they had to detain Spock otherwise because they're like, well, the vests are open in the front. We don't want to see your hairy chest again. So, you
know, right. We've had troubles in the
past.
You're
just going to be lying down for this one.
Okay.
I just got to say, those wigs look like they were dropped on their heads from like 10 feet above and just left. Wherever it lands, that's good. Yeah. Go for it.
Well, again,
just like not even trying to make those things look like real hair.
Backwards. Nah.
It makes it look more alien, I guess.
But. Yeah.
I said the changeling earlier, and that was completely my bad. What I meant was the apple.
That's what I thought you meant.
I wondered about
I heard the apple when you said the changeling.
I said the changeling, but like, you know, they have that kind of wig on wig.
Yeah.
They have a little like, you know, kind of star piece, you know, centered their head. You know, they don't have the red skin, but in every other way, they have that. They have that Barry McGuire look.
Right.
I also, by the way, I love the mountain men, excuse me, the villagers. Yeah. I loved their like that they're all wearing like the beetle wig that the Thing got in, like, I think it's like issue 22 of Fantastic Four.
Right,
it's just like, no, it's like you tuned into an episode of the Dean Martin Variety Show, like, I got a beetle wig, everybody. It's really cool. Bad in a glorious way.
Yeah.
And the leader. I forgot his name. No, not the Hulk, but the leader of the villagers. Every time I say Hulk people,
like I think
it's
like either the cowboy or the construction worker.
Othello? No. I kept thinking he said Othello. Was it like Othello or
hey there, fella.
Something like that?
Hey, fella.
Or did he just say, hey, fella?
Hey, fella, come here.
Here's
a rifle.
Appella. That's what it is.
Appella.
Mm-hmm. Appella. He totally looks like a weird, like almost like Run Ronnie Run or like some or like
or he looked a little like old Doug Henney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Or the guy I forgot in
that
in
is
UHF,
a great pull, John.
There's in UHF, there's Tom... the guy with the ridiculous cowboy hat and the mustache.
Yeah.
And then that goes into the office and he's like, take that ridiculous thing off, and he pulls off the mustache. he looks kind of like that. Like that this guy's just wearing a ridiculous little mustache.
Yep.
And weirdly fake wig. Mm-hmm. And he just looks ridiculous.
All the wigs are just all so ridiculous.
Yeah. But paired with the,
I mean,
the mustache, so like
wiggy. Like
it just looks like
Yeah. And that guy's sick. That guy's weird. The leader of the village, he's like, oh, this killing
thing is
people?
Great.
It's sort of
the cop or the fireman.
I just made that joke.
Made that joke.
He did, but it was good. It's bears that's the kind of joke
that
bears repeating. But he's like, he's like, boy, this killing thing, man, like, killing animals is one thing, but killing people, there's pleasures there that are even better. This is great.
Oh, and then you're like, the suggestion of,
it's totally
like,
the best.
We can't divide one woman and all that. So it's just like, oh my God, these guys are
a little dry. Yeah. You get the idea, though, like, if the Klingons hadn't done anything, that idyllic piece that Kirk knew about from 15 years ago would not last long. Like, the village folks are just primed to be complete sick bastards.
I do want to, like, one thing I actually really, God, it's this weird thing, because I'm not really sure where I land on this episode, but there are certain details I really like. And, like, I like that, I like that the Run, Ronnie, Run leader of the village people.
Right. Is that the cop or the like Native American guy?
Yeah, no, it's the cowboy.
Three times the rules of rule three in comedies.
That's why
I love that the cowboy couldn't stop the music. Number one, right. But number two, I love that little line where he says to, was it Krell? Is that the Klingon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I love where he's just like, wow, I assume that like my villagers, you know, like my people really wouldn't be into like murdering the mountain guys, but you know, I guess you were right. You give them guns. They're going to want to shoot things.
Yeah.
You know,
Chekhov's not in this episode, but Chekhov's gun is.
Yeah, there it is.
Certainly.
I love that Tyree is kind of like, no. They're going to go back to like they're going to get a kick out of this right now, but ultimately it's going to be like, oh, what, killing the mountain people? That's not fun. We should all, you know, be friends again. Like, yeah. It's one of those details I really like, where just sort of like, you know, you're showing, you know, from the village people's perspective, you're kind of showing that like, oh, wow, like my hope in humanity, for lack of a better term, is misguided. And from the mountain people's perspective, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, no, I really want this to be right. I really want like these people to realize killing people is a stupid thing to do. It's just like, I don't think this episode is perfect, but it's like just that one detail where like you do have belief systems with people,
right?
Mm-hmm. With different villagers, and finding on the mountain, on the village people side, womp womp, that it is, you know, that is misguided, and finding on the mountain people side. And I didn't say this before, but that like, yeah, no, I don't understand why they want to kill. Oh my God, I want to kill these people. You know? like they have a belief system that they'd be completely betrayed. It's again, not a perfect, may not be a perfect episode, but it has a little bit of thought to it, which I really appreciated.
But that's my main problem with this episode, is that they go there and then it's just,
well,
like,
we're different people, Pete.
Well, yeah. They go there and then it's like, yeah. And Kirk's like, well, yeah, what are you going to do? And it like, yeah, he's like, well, war isn't a good life, but it's life. And then they're like, well, hey, balance of power. Like the only thing they're giving those guys guns. We have to just give these guys guns. What are you going to do? And it's not like I was expecting it to be this kind of utopian Star Trek thing where like, oh, they do. You're like, Kirk and Krell have a fist fight. And they're like, all right, you Klingons, knock it off. And they get out of here.
Yeah.
And like they somehow, you know, Scotty manages to like beam all the guns away. And then they're like, oh, well. Mm-hmm. But no, they're just kind of like,
we're
ah,
not getting
what can you
a
do?
Piece of that action.
Yeah.
Hey, Scotty, you know, beam down more muskets. And it's just like, well, what?
Yeah.
Like,
we found a horrible situation and now it's a little bit worse. The end.
And again, there is that kind of thing, and it is not as peaceful as, say, a TNG episode would be. But there is that kind of like when you're watching the episode, it's sort of like, what, you know, that is Kirk's dilemma. Like, what is he supposed to do? Is he supposed to like let the mountain people die because the other the other tribe has far superior weapons and have been given like a sort of mandate to rule the planet?
Well, like, but there is a, you know, it's Star Trek. They should have like they should have a sci-fi way to get out of it and fix it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they should have a way to be like, all right, let's, you know, like zap, blow up the forge and then chase the Klingons out. And like, we let the Federation know. And now the Klingons are barred from, you know, approaching. Yep. They have a restraining order against this planet. And, and then it's not going to escalate from here. But instead, they're like, let's escalate a little bit and then we'll come back.
No, and I agree with you. I agree with you entirely, Pete. And like, this is the ending I would have liked to have seen in this episode. But to the episode's credit, I do feel that there's a kind of like, well, what are you going to do? Let's have the moral and intellectual argument without having the kind of fairy tale ending of, do you let these people die or do you equip them, even though by equipping them with weapons, you are basically like disintegrating the Edenic society that they had created.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, that is sort of like, kind of hard hitting, especially in like 1967 television show, 1967 television show, which was kind of for kids, if not entirely, you know? Right.
Yeah. Like I sort of in a weird way admire the bleakness of the ending. Like we say, you know, they found a terrible situation. How are they going to get out of it? Oh, they're not. They're not going to get out of it. They're not going to solve it. It's just going to get worse and worse. But there's a little bit of like a quick kind of glibness to it at the end. It's kind of like, well, it sucks. Beam down as many guns as you can, Scotty. We're leaving. Like, there's no like, I don't know, there should be something between like Kirk and his old friend.
Yeah.
Like, hey, and, I'm sorry I've cursed you to this. You know,
no, I totally
sorry about all the mayhem. Yeah.
He should or be at least more supposed... broken up about it. Instead, he's just kind of like, well, what are you going to do? War. Beam down
my
gun.
You know, I was shocked that there wasn't a like post bridge scene where it's kind of like, where they're discussing the moral implications. It's really they gave it a City on the Edge of Forever ending, where they gave it a just sort of they more or less give it a like, let's get the hell out of here ending. Like I was kind of surprised by that. And I do kind of agree that like I want my Star Trek to be a bit more positive, but I do have to admire that they decided to go with a bleak, you know, ending out of nowhere. And you know what? All these things are making me sad. Let's talk about the white monkey suit with the rhino horn.
Yeah.
I quote my son that came on the, I can't say he watched this episode with me, but he was in the room when the Mugatu showed up. And his exact quote was, that is stupid.
I was like, oh, come you on, know, Sam. I'm going to have to punch your son in the face.
I will
That's
punch
the
him
only
for you.
Solution.
I love the Mugatu.
I love the Mugatu also.
My kids.
It goes without saying.
I watched this with both my kids. And
adorable.
They were looking forward to that. They know of him from the book of Star Trek, Book of Opposites, the furry and scaly, the Gorn and the Mugatu.
Or as most people say, or most people call it, the book that proves you're a good parent, Pete.
That's right.
But good parents. Then they were all excited. I was like, hey, you guys, you want to Star Trek? They're like, yeah. And I was like, it's the one with the furry. And they're like, whoa. Like, and then once he showed up.
I don't know if you want to call him the furry.
I didn't say the furry. He's just a furry.
The
furry.
I'm going to explain that part.
Right. Those are actually just the mountain guys.
The Shining?
Huh? We're going to watch this movie with the village people and a furry.
Speaking of that, somebody's got to Photoshop the Mugatu in that shot from The Shining.
Or in Can't Stop the Music. Now, so
I think Kirk and Mugatu in that. Anyway. Yeah, so they were excited for that, and then he shows up, and they're like, whoa, why is he attacking Kirk? And I was like, well, he's kind of, and like, before I could even finish, the McCoy zaps him, and he disappears. Like, what's going on? They were so, like, they're like, I thought this was going to be, like a lovable creature of some sort. They're like, I was looking forward to this, and then he just shows up and bites somebody and gets zapped. And then when the other one shows up, they're like, why is he back? And I was like, it was confusing,
one.
But they liked him.
Okay.
So the other one is the mate of the other, like, yeah, they pretty much imply that that's the case. Oh, I'm just making sure that I'm right about that.
I think
Yeah.
They say its mate will be looking for you.
So they wipe out an entire family in this episode.
Yeah.
I do sort of enjoy that there's a throwaway line that Tyree makes to the effect of, like, well, we could do that at night, but that's when the Mugatu are all out there. Like, that is when the Mugatu hunt. That is when they're available. That is when the Mugatu are raccoons.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, all right, well, that's good to know. But the only time we actually see the Mugatu is in the daytime.
Yeah.
And not only in the daytime, in the bright, not meant to be night, even, you know,
like, should be
like
noted,
even in day for night
scout.
Versions of filming, like, you know, like the Mugatu might as well have worn sunglasses and had a parasol.
Yeah.
I would like that.
Yeah. Well, who wouldn't? It's the Mugatu. It's beautiful. A white gorilla with a rhino horn. Like, it's the best thing that could be a thing.
It's pretty great.
Is this the most violent episode of Star Trek, the original series? Because after a while, it started a pile. Like, Spock gets shot through.
Right.
McCoy gets shot in the arm.
Yeah.
Right.
Kirk gets mauled and bitten by a giant monster. The woman, the witchy woman, she gets like attacked and almost, you know, gang horrible things happening to her.
Let's not even begin with that. You know?
Yeah, but it's just and, you know, two Mugatu get killed and everything. It's like it was around the time McCoy got shot in the arm. I'm like, God, well, stop it.
Well, there's that moment really at the end, during the end battle, where it looks like Kirk just completely crushes somebody's skull with
a
rock for a second. I'm like, what happened there exactly? Because I don't think I really did that, but...
And furthermore, Kirk has to stop somebody else from crushing somebody's head in with, with a rock. You know?
Yeah.
You have a solid point there, Tom.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious to, like, somehow tally up, like, all the other deaths and maulings and shootings and stuff in any other episode. I mean, you know, we get a lot of fist fights and things, but...
Now, Tom, you're an award-winning author.
That's right. Sure.
How do you feel about, like, one thing I appreciate in the episode, I'm curious to know your opinion, is how did you feel that within the limited time frame of the episode, they did manage to establish a people, you know, like a townsfolk, a sort of wilder, you know, mountain folk, but also a witch class?
Yeah.
Is that the sort of world building that you appreciate, or is that a kind of thing where you're like, maybe you're overfilling this?
No, I thought that was all like good, solid stuff to have in there, but I was sort of confused by a lot of it. Like when they were talking about the village, the village people and stuff, you know, you expect to see an Indian and a cowboy and
a police officer,
and a construction worker.
I didn't see any construction workers in this one.
No, but
I was going to go. Deeper into that. You're in the middle of a sentence. So it's like, well, we've got the natives. We've got like this was written by a former police officer.
Yeah,
it's got.
They're all kind of in the Navy.
Now, was that former police officer married to Felicia Rashad? I don't know, but we can assume that yes.
Wow, there are a lot of facts to know, aren't there?
I just got distracted by the fact that. Sorry, I'm not going to interrupt you again. Keep going.
Oh, come on.
Point. I bet it was a good, happily divergent into Can't Stop the Music.
All I want to say is they talk about the people who are the villagers, and you're picturing, like, you know, maybe kind of huts and things, but they got buildings. They got, like, legit, you know, like adobe structures and stuff, and that kind of threw me. There's a big disparity between the mountain people and the village people and what they can do and what they have and stuff.
If I may, it would seem that the village people had a sort of like a medieval, at least, level of civilization. Like there did seem to be a village. They weren't tents or teepees or yurts. Right. They were like actual like stone, mud and, stone, mud and cement buildings that in their society.
But they are buildings. They're like, yes, that's a lot more than we see from the mountain folk.
Yes.
So, far as the witch goes, the witch class, her whole deal confused me a lot because I couldn't tell. She's constantly saying to her husband, "Oh, you got to fight. You need to fight those village people and everything. They've got like one good record. There's like three hits on it, maybe, and that's it." but I don't. But I can never tell if she's. Then she steals Kirk's gun and tries to take it to the village people and give it to them. And so, like, I never know what her deal is. Is she just like a war crazy person who just wants there to be a lot of killing and destruction? And she feeds off that or something? Or is it?
Yeah, I think she was just power hungry, right?
She's like Lady Macbeth, man. Yeah. And, like, clearly the Lady Macbeth. And then it's like, just feed men the idea of having more power. Just, that's all I care about. You should have more power. Oh, you don't want it? Okay, he should have more power. It's kind of... Yeah, well, not a very well-drawn character, but clearly a reference to Macbeth.
Sure.
I kind of looked at it as a sort of like D&D cast of people, cast with an E at the end, they are the, like, the witch folk are kind of like, we're very good at, our herbal remedies and cures, and what our job, and our value in this society is that, like, we basically make leaders. We basically make the ruling class stronger if you abide by us. And if you don't, what can you do? And I kind of looked at her as sort of, it was weird that she would like, it's a Gene Roddenberry thing that she had no emotional attachment to Tyree whatsoever.
Right.
But it's sort of like, and that is kind of an issue I have with this episode. But it is kind of interesting that she will immediately, like, why, that she sort of immediately sussed out, okay, mountain people.
The hill people.
The hill people.
Because I keep thinking of Lothar of the hill people.
The hill people. The hill folk won a world without war. The mountain people, the village people. Want a world where they can be dominant. I have a weapon. I am a value to the village people.
Yeah. Womp,
but I am not of value to the mountain people anymore, despite the fact that I was the leader of the mountain peoples, the hill folk.
If Tyree had been open to going to war, she would have just handed that phaser over to him, and she would have been
theoretically
happy.
Yes. Yeah. That is sort of like, again, they're like weirdly, I don't say they all pay off, but they are really interesting things about this episode that, you know, sort of make it a cut above. Like, the two things I thought when I was originally watching is like, wow, there's a lot of things that remind me of Lost in Space, and there's a lot of things that remind me of the Planet of the Apes television show. But having said that, and I love both of those properties, it does maintain its Star Trek-iness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I kind of wish it did a little more, but for what it does it well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's super weird, and this kind of fits into what you're saying about her character and the role she and her people might play in society. Like, the fact that Tyree is 100% fine with the fact that she brainwashed him, or, you know, put a spell on him. Oh yeah, that's the night you put a spell on me. That was cool. Thank you for that. Yeah. He's like,
but what the witch people do.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah,
like they kind of they're like a seduction class of people. Yeah, you know.
And he gets that, and he's fine with it. Oh yeah, you took it. I'm under your spell. Okay. Well, what do you want me to do now? I'm not going to do that, but, you know.
Yeah.
Right. I'll do anything for love, but I won't do that.
No, not that.
Let me look at the leftover notes here are, this is the only episode in which Kirk and Spock are incapacitated independently.
Yeah.
There's some episodes where they're like, one is incapacitated, the other one has to act, vice versa. There's some where they're both like knocked out together or captured together, but this is the first one where they're separated and incapacitated at the same time.
Yeah.
And the only one.
That's cool and weird. That's why everybody else gets lines on the bridge.
Also, it's a weird line for Spock when he's there's that thing where he's like, he's gone into his little like Vulcan self-induced coma, and then he needs to come out of it, and he gets Chapel to hit him, and then, you know, Scotty for some reason is just wandering around, like, what are you doing, woman? And then Mabanga comes in and is like, no, we gotta, but there's that weird, like, Spock says, if I don't regain consciousness soon, it'll be too late. And it was like, well, wait, how are you talking? Like, it's like, that is consciousness. You are conscious. So it's not too late.
So there's also that thing where Mbeng is like, okay, no, whatever he does, do it. Like, dude, just do whatever he tells you. Like, anything? And it's like, it's very young Frankenstein. It's like,
it's very clear. I think it's very clear. You know, it's like, what?
It's not. Yeah, give me something to, what should I expect? Yeah.
No time to explain.
Yeah.
I have to leave the room now.
Yeah. It's my lunch
hour. Anything he says, remember.
Spock should have taken advantage of that.
While we're back on Mbenga for a second, I was distracted by the fact that he was, one of his roles is Sam Gritt, the editor, basically the J. Jonah Jameson of Goldie Gold and Action Jack, which was a cartoon created by Steve Gerber that I liked from the 80s.
Wow. 1981. Plastic Man Variety Hour shows, if I recall.
Wow.
Let's see. It just says it was just one season on ABC. I don't know if it's... doesn't say that it was specifically in there, but it seems like that kind of that does ring a bell.
Like, if I'm not wrong,
right?
If I'm not right, excuse me, I'm not that far into the wrong territory.
No, yeah,
you still get. Yeah.
It might have been like Batman and the Super Seven, you know.
but yeah, it's a Steve Gerber and Jack Kirby creation, but basically the only other recurring character besides Goldie Gold and Action Jack and the dog. Was the editor in chief, who was like this J. Jonah Jameson type of guy named Sam Gritt, and that was Booker Bradshaw, Dr. Mbenga.
Hey. Nice.
Here's another note. When after the Lothar and the Hill people kill his wife, Tyree is like, I will kill them. And I wanted him to say it again, like turn around to say everybody like, I will kill them. But he did not.
But no.
No.
There is actually one other thing that I forgot about this episode.
That's keeping it off the A-list.
Aw. But the there's a cool element to this episode where, you know, I forget Anona. She does the herb thing with Kirk and kind of, mm-hmm. you know, he's under her spell. But then for the rest of the episode, you don't know. He's talking about, like, oh, we got to arm them, or I'm going nuts as a captain. I'm going to arm them. It's the only thing we can do and stuff. And you're like, you don't actually know if he's doing that because he's under her spell or if he, as the captain, thinks it's the right thing to do. And eventually you're like, oh, no, he's just being Kirk. That's he thinks he's got to do this. But like for a while, you're like, oh, wait, does he? Should I be seeing him as nuts right now or just as kind of driven and making that tough decisions and stuff? I don't know. That was kind of interesting.
I assume it's kind of like a couple of hours. Because there's the
where
a couple of owls.
Yeah. Hours. Oh, okay. Because hours Nona says to you know, because Nona says to the other hill folk, yeah, when Tyree snaps out of it.
Right. He's just standing over there, kind of grinning to himself. Yeah. That's true. But you would think that, you know, in this episode where you've got somebody who can take over people's minds or at least, you know, convince them to do stuff and things, that our main character doing something that other main characters think is nuts, that would be a factor. But it doesn't seem to be a factor. So I can't tell. Yeah. Okay, now that I'm talking about it, I can't tell if I think it's cool or if I think it's just kind of lazy and awkward and not quite there.
I would bet a small amount of money, not a large amount of money, a small amount of money, that the whole thing with Nona was Roddenberry. I'm assuming that it's, you know, that's part of why.
Are you going to put a wager on the sky being blue?
I put a small amount of money. But it seems like, you know, that's the type of stuff that was, like, you know, slathered onto it and then not appreciated by the original writer. So I haven't seen it. I would like to see a, you know, an original draft, but I don't know. Maybe one day.
Someday.
But, well, that goes into the thing that backing up for a second. First, let me qualify it as a command episode because it is about the decisions that Kirk has to make. Clear decisions. Sure. But it, the Nona thing is part of what I don't like about this episode. There's a handful of things, and the Nona thing seems misplaced. It seems kind of, you know, shallow, misogynistic wrinkle that doesn't need to be there. And then also the just pure downerness of the whole thing, that is not, there is no answer, which is, yes, it is. And I don't want to sound like one of these people who's just like, oh, get your politics. I just want to watch TV and enjoy it. Like, but it, there's a certain, like, utopian aspect that I appreciate to Star Trek, especially the original series, where it's just like, oh, we have this magic thing, you know, like I said, like Scotty figured out the frequency of iron and we just deleted all the iron from the planet or something, you know what I mean? Like, some weird, like, you know, random pull it out of a hat, you know, thing where it's like, we're going to make it all okay.
If I may, the whole gist of Star Trek is we can be better.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is an episode that fails on that premise.
Yeah.
And and it's specifically Roddenberry who insisted upon that, even up into the TNG era.
Yeah.
And it's kind of weird that he would rewrite this thing, you know. I imagine he rewrote it. I mean, if Christ on the cross or whatever he called himself is so mad about his script getting rewritten, I imagine the ending must have been different. I imagine the basic gist. I don't think he would just be mad about a couple of things getting changed.
And it's not even like a dilemma for Kirk. Choice. Kirk is, he's almost immediately like, oh, we got to get as many guns as we can and get them to my friends because this is all Klingon screwed it up and now we got to screw it up even more. Like, it's not, he doesn't even wrestle with it. He's kind of there halfway through the episode.
Which is an early, again, early evidence of his racism towards Klingons, which will come full circle later on in the movies. But
he'll never forget them. Yeah. The death of his son.
Or his friend Tyree, indirectly.
Let them die, he said.
Yes.
Let them die, he said.
Yeah. So he's had a long-standing hatred of Klingons. He easily pins it on his son, but he didn't care that much about his son.
Yeah.
But even trying to, like, you know, trying to preserve his friend, you know, he's barely mourning the peaceful life that his friend had and that he experienced there. Like, it's kind of like, oh, it's done. We got to blow everything up.
Yeah.
As many guns as we can.
Also, his whole solution kind of like hamstrings the Federation. I mean,
yeah,
you know, the Enterprise is on a like exploratory mission, but somebody, you know, some Federation supervisor has to be at this planet to basically make sure the balance of power is equal. Like, right. If they're going to submit to a, okay, if the Beetlewig people
right.
get their, you know, are going to get like Flintlock, then Matchlock, and then Wheellocks, or whatever the order of technology is, then we have to make sure that the, you know, the mountain folk get the same thing. That basically is like, yeah, you know what? You're going to have to stay on this planet. Otherwise, a society will be written out of existence, and the Klingons have another planet in their empire.
Right.
So Kirk is basically Oliver North, right? By the end of this episode. Kinda, is this basically Iran-Contra?
Right.
No, he's still sort of like situation. Smart. Hey-o.
Hey-o. But yeah, it's a like, I want to know how this went over with the people who were fans of Star Trek at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, because it seems like, I could be projecting, but based on, you know, seems like a lot of the people who were really into Star Trek would also be the people who were not that into Vietnam. And this mm-hmm. basically seems to be like the moral of the story.
Yeah, I think that's
like,
a safe assertion to make.
And the I think the moral of the story is basically like, what can you do? We gotta do Vietnam, you know, essentially.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like, and again, if it was... If there was a lot of moral back and forth, you know, figuring it out. If that was so go back again. Maybe this is the draft that John Ingalls submitted. Maybe it's, you know, more discussion of what's right here and how can we do this without, you know, ruining another society. Because they talk about that. They talk about how it, you know, like, oh, yeah, we mm-hmm. were nice. And then we started shooting each other. And mm-hmm. if there was more wrestling with that and less, you know, sorry, everybody, less Mugatu and less witch woman and less, you know, of all that stuff, I think it might be a more satisfying episode.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of think if you actually did the opposite, if you had more witch woman and white ape and rhino horn and less on the actual socio-political, you know, metaphors they're using, it would probably be a lot more fun. Also, I recommend fun, a robot sure. at Dr. Smith and Will Robinson.
Right. Well.
But this could be, I mean, given like, yeah, exactly. Well, like when what was going on in the world when the episode came out, like people watching it would be like, okay, you kind of get that it ends with it as a downer, but it doesn't seem to know that it's a downer ending. It's just sort of right. like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. What are you going
to
do?
Like, if you wrestle with it a little bit, you have more time without a Mugatu and a witchy woman. You have more time to, you know, wrestle with it and figure stuff out and come to this sad conclusion that actually lands as a dramatic thing. That'd be kind of fun and satisfying. But it's not really that.
No. Who sings Witchy Woman?
Eagles.
Oh, the Eagles.
Yes.
But it Black is? Magic.
Oh, so obviously we know it's terrible.
Black Magic mm-hmm. Woman is Santana. Huh?
That's right. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
But doesn't...
Huh? And Season one of the Witch is Donovan.
Didn't Fleetwood Mac do one of those?
They did...
Originally, even? I don't know.
Hmm.
Hmm. Which one did the Village People do?
And who did Edge of 17?
Stevie Nicks.
That was Stevie Nicks.
Yeah.
And Back in a New York Groove?
That was Ace Frehley.
Yeah.
Mm. And the album Destroyer? wait, who did Led Zeppelin 4?
Frank Sinatra.
Okay, that it all makes sense.
Then
who did Watertown? That was a failed aquarium. Frank Sinatra.
Oh God, album.
I pushed it too far, but
ring
I'm proud
a ding,
that I did.
Ding.
Side note has nothing to do with that, but speaking of music, I just want to let everybody know, because it was still in my head from last week's episode, that you can listen to Made in Wine by Leonard Nimoy on Spotify.
Oh boy.
And it's like a more orchestrated version. It's not just him with the zither or whatever that was, but
what if we don't want to listen to it?
Double side note, I heard Made in Wine and I thought, wait, is that a Lee Hazelwood song?
It should be.
Because like, I'm thinking of Summer Wine and it's not.
Yeah.
But oh man, if Lee Hazelwood and Leonard Nimoy combined their talents, the things we would have.
It wasn't meant to be.
So I don't know what to grade this because I don't really care for this episode. and I want to, but I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go first because I have mixed feelings. I want a barometer to which I can judge my opinions on.
John is talking
to
his hand.
At John.
Yeah.
John is getting the universal.
Another, it is me, Pierre.
It's another one of those, like, just straight up C, kind of like, meh, episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Man, the Mugatu, though, might take it to a C+. I think I'll go C+.
Really? Again, just why I love and admire you, John.
Yeah, I mean, that's the... I love that thing.
Yeah.
I need a stuffed one in the house. I'm sure there's one out there.
Just get a life-size one for. Just to freak everybody out every once in a while. Or hide it in the closet or something.
Am I going to have to buy everybody a Mugatu Tiki mug? Is that what we're all saying?
You already did.
Oh, yeah.
No, I got just like Gorn.
It looks just like the Gorn, but it said it was a Mugatu, so what are you going to do? I think.
Go ahead. Was I think it Tom's going to go first?
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh,
I mean, no, second. I went first.
Tom's
John
go
already went first. I did have a valid grade there.
Yeah, he did, and it reminded me of my thinking about his grade from, I think it was last time. Like the way the what did we do last time? I don't even know.
Plato stepchildren.
Yes. And so the things you liked about this episode brought it up from a C to a C plus. I think the things I like about it bring it from like a C minus to a C maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's frustrating. I feel like there could be a good episode here, like a kind of like authentically dour, you know, grim, but like, you know, emotionally satisfying episode where Kirk just for once has to throw up his hands and go, there's nothing I can do. This is a horrible situation. It would almost be like a wink to the camera, like, well, what would that be like, people of 1969, you know? But, I don't know. There's not. Yeah, it's all. None of it doesn't really hang together. There's too many questions. There is a Mugatu, and that's great. The witchy woman is pretty.
There's a Mugatu, and that's great.
Yeah, those village people are just horrible. They're so mean. He also looks like Blue Lou. That guy. He looks like Blue Lou from the Blues Brothers with the mustache and yeah.
All right.
He does.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give my grades. Until the end, because I want to figure out exactly what it is.
Okay.
One thing we didn't mention, this is gloriously bonkers Shatner.
Yeah.
Like, Shatner being sick from the Mugatu bite is just amazing.
Yeah.
The direction of the episode with a lot of, I guess, you know, first person visual of Nana, but even if it's not, it's just Shatner in the camera doing Shatner things.
Yeah,
is amazing. So we got that, and that kind of thing. I kind of put in a Lost in Space kind of territory where we're watching this for camp and candy fun.
Right, camp candy.
Yes,
camp
yes,
candy we're fun.
Right,
exactly. And if anybody has any problems with John Candy, I'll happily fight you bare-knuckled.
Or with animated John Candy.
Right? Or with animated John Candy, for that matter. So you have that. You have the Mugatu. And on some level, you have the chutzpah of...
The chutzpah's in a different episode. This is a monster on
but to Gene Roddenberry's credit, you do have the chutzpah of, like, deciding to end this on a dour note. And yes, you had things like, you know, the Twilight Zone of the Outer Limits, which could end in a, and then we solved everything and the world's going to die in equal measure. But that's, you know, that kind of ends roughly around 1965. By the time you get to like a color, episodic sort of action adventure, sci-fi, whatever it is show, you basically expect, whoever Peter Graves' character on Mission Impossible was to solve the problem.
Phelps. Yeah.
Phelps. You accept.
Michael
you
Phelps.
Expect, yes. You expect. No, not Michael Phelps. You that's the swimmer. You expect, Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kurakin to solve the problem. Did you know? And I could go on every like kind of spy adventure show or the family or, you know, the Family Robinson to solve the thing in a acceptable way. There is a sort of, you know, there is a nerve to having the, to having basically the hero of your show says, yeah, I don't know what to do, so I guess I'm going to give them guns, even though, and you know, having them say like 100 serpents, that's what I need,
right?
As you know, sort of cheesy, yeah, a sort of biblical reference as it is, it does kind of say like, I don't like this idea, I just can't think of anything better. Mm-hmm. And either we arm my friends or we let them die to the village people. right. womp womp again.
As we all did, you know, in the 70s.
So again, like, but yet I don't feel like it really deserves to go into the B's. And I'm sorry for, you know, rambling on, but I guess I'm going to give it a C plus because there's enough that's like kind of cheesy fun that I like. And there's enough ideas that I kind of like. Like, I want this episode to be a B plus, but it can't be because mm-hmm. it's just not that well done.
Right.
But what it does have is strong and you're just kind of like, you know, it's kind of like watching Pete, I'll ask you, and I can ask any of you with a different sport. Who's a crappy hockey team that everybody likes? That like the people who are fans really enjoy.
Well, so you're tempting me to make jokes at other teams' expenses, but
let's just say the Islanders.
No, come on now.
Like, you want the Islanders to be a good team, but reality just doesn't bear that out. So you're kind of like, you lost, and I can't help the fact that you lost. But what are you going to do? You're not good.
Right.
And that's, you know, how
I mean, that's very much
Islanders.
An Islanders vibe. It's that second shelf New York team, you know, the Mets, Jets, Islanders vibe.
The suburban, like team of right, yeah, like 60s and on.
I agree with a lot of what you guys said, and I think same ballpark. I might just go with Tom with a flat C because
it works.
I think I want it to be, there are some good things in it, but I want it to be more, like, again, it's that, maybe it's the direction, I don't know, but there is something about it. It feels a little too, not glib, but a bit like, if it's going to be a downer, it should be more of a downer. It should make me think like, oh, mm-hmm. God.
It should be City on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, all Star Trek episodes should be.
Yeah. all Star Trek episodes should be a classic version yeah. of a 1960s television show.
Right.
It's going to end on a downer. Earn that.
Yeah.
Don't just end on a downer because you don't know what else to do.
Right. Although I do love the idea.
I'm not sure that's the case here, but it kind of feels like that's the case here.
I do love the idea of Scotty being on the other end of the phone and Kirk being like, Scotty, you know, how long will it take you to make 100 muskets? And being like, what? And he's like, 100 serpents. And he's like, what? And he's
I
like,
didn't I'm understand like, so what you confusing. Literally meant. And then how like, am I supposed to get your metaphor?
But then Kirk is just like, maybe I'm 100 tired.
Heaters.
And, like, hangs up
heaters. Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, heaters. But it's, yeah, it's like 100 muskets. I mean, 100
I'm
serpents.
Not
I mean,
clever.
I'm tired and hangs up on him.
Yeah, it's like really weird that he gets poetic and then even more confusing. And then he goes, I'm tired.
And we've more than established that Scotty metaphor is not his strength.
Right.
Like, that is true.
Why do you keep, and you know, Scotty's a fantastic engineer. He loves the Enterprise. God knows the Enterprise has needed Scotty to get them out of more than enough hot water. Mm-hmm. But metaphor, not his strength.
Right.
You know, as we'll see in a later episode, he's never even read his Milton, even though he's a Scot.
Shameful.
Well, hey, you know what? You know what we're good at? The alphabet, because we just finished the letter P.
Oh, my what? God. Look at that.
God, we're so
everybody.
Good at the alphabet.
Time for the Q's.
We're done
what
with
do
the
P's.
No, but, and as we joked, it's the original series, so there's no Q.
Oh.
And we're heading straight for the R's. We've got three R's coming up. Reading, writing,
and arithmetic.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. No, we got three R's, starting with Requiem for Methuselah.
Mm. Not to be confused with the pirate movie.
No.
A that pirate? Is rated R.
Oh,
very, very good.
Requiem
you hired
for Methuselah
me for the jokes.
Quite
will
humorous.
Be our first episode of the new year. Happy New Year, everybody.
Hey.
We'll see you on January
4th.
Hope
you all had a Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays.
A crazy Kwanzaa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A all
very
of the above.
Solemn, dignified Ramadan.
And here's to 22. We'll see you in 22. With
a jaunty Janica.
Sure. And that's it. Well, so hopefully you're enjoying Subspace Chatter if you're a Patreon supporter, and social media. We're ABCDTOS. And then new episode back here next week, 2022. Star Trek.
Mm. Bye, everybody.
Pew pew. I made my thing reference earlier.